not just the story of Christmas, but the fact that the coming of Jesus in that moment that we kind of take a snapshot of, right, in the manger scene, you see out in front of churches and on gift cards, that little scene of the baby in the manger and the wise men and Joseph and Mary and the animals and all that. That moment was anticipated for thousands of years before that. And if we remove that moment from that expectation, we miss half the story, right? And so I want to kind of go back maybe to Genesis and just look at just for a minute really quickly. Okay, don't get nervous here. It's Christmas Sunday, man. What are you doing? No, it's not going to take long. Just real quickly, like look at how from Genesis all the way up to Luke chapter 2, he's anticipated. And then look at, in light of that, how crazy it is the way that he came. Okay? So going back to Adam and Eve, from Adam to Noah to Abraham, Isaac, Judah, Joseph, Moses, Joshua, and the prophets and the kings of Israel, all the way through David, then John the Baptist, we see anticipation and desperation building for a rescue from heaven. Timers begin. Right in the beginning, at the fall of Adam and Eve, God promised. Remember Genesis 3:15. They fall, they eat the thing that God told them not to eat. They do the thing, one thing God told them not to do, they do it. And sin enters not just the world, but enters them and their very nature. And God immediately promises in Genesis 3:15, he says, I'm going to send he, a man, talking to Eve. He says, he will come and crush Satan under his feet. From the very beginning, from the moment sin entered the world, God had a solution. And I would say before sin entered the world, God had a solution. Because God is God. But he promised that one would come, a man that would crush Satan under his feet. Genesis 3:15. And in the days of Noah, the sin would grow like an infectious disease to the point where God, in his just wrath, would destroy the sin of the world. And the only way possible, he would destroy all of mankind. It's the most gruesome story in Scripture, but we really cutify it, don't we? And we make all the animals and everything look so sweet. But this is God destroying mankind. You know, this, the only way he could get sin out of the world was to destroy everybody. But remember, in the wake of that wrath would come a promise that was given to Noah, signified by the rainbow. God would promise never to cleanse the world of sin through the death of many. Instead, he would cleanse the world of sin through the death of one, Jesus Christ. Then God's covenant with Abraham foreshadowed a future covenant where God would swear on his own blood to once and for all make his people righteous. We like lived in that whole story all the way through the book of Genesis a few months ago. Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his only son Isaac, remember that story? Only to have an innocent ram provided in his place pointed forward to a day when God would sacrifice his only son for the sins of the world. Right there on that mountaintop, God was talking about Jesus. Later, God would send Moses, who was a Jew, into the foreign land of Egypt to live as one of them. He would look, sound, and act like an Egyptian, but God would call him out as a prophet to gather and lead his chosen people out of Egypt and into the promised land that God had promised to Abraham so many years before. In the same way, Jesus would later come and live among us. He would look like us, sound like us, talk like us. But then John the Baptist would baptize him and God would call him, Jesus, out to gather his chosen people, us, and lead them out of spiritual captivity and into the true promise of righteousness through the grace of God. All the way through all of these things is pointing to Jesus. And then, you've got all the prophets. Most obviously, Isaiah. We always read at Christmas time, which we're going to read now, Isaiah chapter 9. Why don't we turn there? You don't have a Bible, you forgot yours, there should be one nearby under a seat. Isaiah chapter 9, look at this. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has a light shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Can you imagine what hope that would be for an oppressed, downtrodden, broken people to hear your prophet say there's going to be the one that comes and he's going to break the rod of your oppressor and destroy your opposition. And he's going to carry the government, because they thought the government meant their nation, their actual government. And he would carry their government, and they would be like kings of the world. They would rule, right? They would be unstoppable. They would be suddenly acknowledged as being the chosen people of God, this tiny little nation of Israel. And what they found out, well, some of them found out later, was that Jesus' government is different. It has nothing to do at all with human government. Then, of course, Isaiah later prophesies his death in Isaiah chapter 53. So just turn a few pages over. Let's back up a little bit. Chapter 52, starting in verse 13. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was just a man. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who consider that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked, and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. And he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide my portion with him, a portion with the many. And he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. That's amazing. That was long before Jesus was born. And here are these people that sort of represent us. And they are being told over and over and over again, just through events in history, that there's going to be somebody. I know it's bad now. I know you're crushed and you're oppressed and you're forgotten. You're pushed aside. You're like a little dot on the map. You're not even really a dot on the map. You're not even on the map. You're just somebody to walk on. And he promises over and over and over again, someone's coming, and this anticipation in the world is growing. 100 years passes, another 100 years passes, another 100 years passes. The world is aching for him to come. And then we have, after the prophet Malachi, the book of Malachi, right there at the end of the New Testament, there's over 400 years of silence. There's a 400-year gap in between the Old Testament and the New Testament, where there's no prophets prophesying. It's just, it's like the horrible calm before the storm. Israel during that time is conquered by Rome, who rules them with an iron, abusive, bloody fist. Rome allows them to worship their God, but taxes them into poverty, abuses their women, and holds them under oppression. If you know anything about the Roman Empire at the time, they were huge. It was spread out so far and so wide. We didn't have like cars and trucks and tanks and airplanes and telephones and all these ways of like sending troops and controlling large, vast empires. So at the time, the only way for Rome, the leadership of Rome, to control all that they had conquered was to give their centurion guards carte blanche, absolute power. Judge, jury, executioner. And to rule with an iron fist. And so they sent all their armies out to all these places they had conquered, including Israel. And they would just say, look, we're going to tax them to death. And by taxing, we mean we're going to take all your money. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to, like, get traitors from among you and say, and we're going to say to them, look, okay, you're like Matthew. Matthew was a tax collector. Look, you know everybody. You're local. You're aware of, you know, who lives where, who's rich, who has money, who doesn't, where everybody lives. We want you to collect taxes for us. Okay? And you can collect however much taxes you want to. This is what we want. You keep whatever you collect is over that. So of course they're just gonna take whatever they want. Roman soldiers, there are stories about Roman soldiers coming into homes and raping the wife and the daughters right there in front of the men. And if you resisted, they would just simply kill you out in the street and leave you there. This is what's happening when Jesus comes. Imagine how you would hold on to a prophecy like Isaiah chapter 9 that says there's one that's going to come and he's going to break the back of the oppressor. He's going to break his rod of iron, his sword that he uses to kill your husbands and to threaten your wives and your daughters and to take all your money to keep you oppressed through poverty and oppression. There's one that's going to come, and he's going to rescue all of you, and he's going to make this, there's going to be this government that there's no end to it. You're going to be like Rome. You're going to take the place of your oppressor and just take over the world. It's going to be you, and everyone's going to threaten you anymore. By the time Jesus came, the longing for a Messiah that would rescue them was certainly at a fever pitch. And then the Son of God finally enters into creation. He crosses the line. Remember last week he talked about life above the line and below the line. He crosses the line, makes himself fully and completely human while still remaining fully God. This is what we call the incarnation of Christ. This is Christmas. And it is the most profound and glorious mystery the world has ever been privileged to look into. It is still inexplicable. It is the miracle of all miracles. But why does Jesus choose to reveal himself in the way that he did? Let's look at who Jesus, God, revealed himself to first. It's pretty interesting and pretty telling about who he came for. Jesus was revealed as the Messiah to a very select group of people early in his life, especially in the first days. All of them were not who we would expect God to reveal his coming to, especially in light of the fact there was all this anticipation, all this prophecy, all these stories that they looked at and said, oh, Isaac, he's like, he's a signpost pointing to the Messiah. What a great story. And their children would learn these stories, and it was a hope to them. First, we have the peasant girl Mary in the most backwater town of Bethlehem. Wasn't even on the map. I mean, I grew up in a small southern town, but it was big enough to be on the map. Bethlehem literally was not counted in the census. It was too small. You'd ask somebody where Bethlehem was, and if they weren't from around Bethlehem, they wouldn't know where it was. This little poor peasant girl who was at best a maid in someone else's house, just a step above a slave. Okay? This is not a woman. The only thing she, only claim to fame she has is she's a descendant of David, which qualifies her prophetically for the being the line of the Messiah. But that's all she has. In the most backward town of Israel, this woman would carry this baby king. He would be born in the most obscure way any of us could imagine. The hotel they were supposed to go to was full up, so the owner of the hotel puts them in the barn, the shed out back. Now let's think about what this means. In this culture, if you were a person of status and you came to a hotel that was full, whoever was, if there's anybody of lower status than you in that hotel, they get booted out and you go in their place. This is how it worked. It wasn't a first come, first serve culture. It wasn't like you and I going to the hotel and saying, I'd like a room, and they say, we just don't have any rooms. No, if you were a muckety-muck of any kind, then the person of lower status gets kicked out. That means, the fact that they got in the barn means that they were the lowest cultural status that there could be, because there was not one person they could trump in that entire hotel. In the middle of the night, a pregnant woman. So they go to the shed, the lean-to, out back, next to the garbage, where the animals poop, where the animals eat, and where they sleep. So this baby king, the one prophesied about by Isaiah, the hope of the world, born in a feeding trough, not sterile, not even remotely clean, no nurses or doctors to help if something went wrong. It's from this shed out behind the local Motel 6 that the first cries of the God-man were heard, and no one would have noticed. Imagine the sound of that first cry, the miracle that that is. If you've ever been present when a baby is born and that first scream comes out. This was even more special as the sound of the Messiah who had entered in to creation, the creation he created, going out into the night, and there's no one even to hear it because he's in a shed out back behind the Motel 6. Except the angels, right? They would notice. They did. And they would gather excitedly to finally do their thing. They had the song all picked out, the classic Holy, 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 right? They're all ready, they're excited, there's a fervor, and they're already just moving their wings, and they're excited. Can you believe what just happened? Let's go tell, okay, God, who do we tell? Who do we announce it to? Is it Herod? I mean, it's gotta be somebody important, because we gotta get the word out that this thing has happened. Can you believe it? You're there! And God says, those redneck shepherds, behind that hill, where? Yeah, behind the hill, there's some sheep. Just follow the smell. Yeah, really? You want us to go where? So the big announcement, the big to-do, the big show they've been practicing for centuries. The angels all set up, ready to go, and what do they announce it to? Who do they announce it to? A bunch of probably illiterate, working-class sheep herders in a field somewhere. At the worst time, in the middle of the night, when everybody's asleep and there's nobody to see it. It's like if you're going to plan a big announcement, like, you know, you're going to run for office or something, right? You're not going to do it in the middle of the night on a field somewhere and not tell anybody. This is what God did. Can you imagine what it was like for those guys sitting around a campfire The day's ended. Somebody is probably telling an inappropriate joke. This is not a holy moment for them. This is like, imagine a construction site in New York City, and a bunch of dudes standing around, sweaty, foul men, working a job. And suddenly, out of the midnight sky comes a bunch of glowing, flying winged creatures saying, they say, "For unto you this day a child is born." What? Us? Huh? Bill, they must be talking about the boss. It can't be me. I think you got the wrong guy, right? Hey, the city's that way, right? No, he appears to these men. Gives me hope. What about the wise men, the magi from the Orient, pagan astrologists? A lot of interesting facts about these guys. We don't actually know how many there were. The Bible doesn't say much about them, but historically we know that these are probably the, they were called, we get our word magician from this, but they were scientists and philosophers, and they were the kingmakers of Persia. These were the guys who would, if you wanted to become king or take any kind of government leadership role at all, you had to go to this group of men and ask, "Do you approve of our decision?" They were extremely powerful, but extremely paganistic. And at some point, probably they came into contact with Daniel. It's kind of interesting, but magi are mentioned in the book of Daniel. They probably learned of the prophecies about the Messiah and knew all of this, and God had used the stars to show them when he was coming. He's entered into their, this will mess with your doctrine a little bit, entered into their paganistic stuff and spoke to them and showed them that the Messiah was coming, and they came. So here God has to, in order to crown Jesus as the coming king, not government man king, but king of the kingdom of God. In order for God to do that, he has to go thousands of miles away to a bunch of pagan kingmakers and bring them in. He can't go to the priests and the priestly class of Israel because they're going to kill him. And they can't go to Herod because Herod is going to kill him. They have to go to a bunch of pagans and bring them in. This is astounding to me. And then we have 8 days later, after Jesus is born, they bring, as was tradition, they bring the baby to do a baby dedication at the temple. It's like, you know, we a lot of us still do this today. You know, you have a baby, and then at some point when they're sort of presentable, don't have the huge water head and all that, you bring them to church in some kind of get up, right? And you bring them up front and you dedicate them to the Lord. This is the same thing. Okay. This is their version of that. Okay. They bring Jesus, the baby Jesus, to the temple, to dedicate him to the Lord. And this really cool guy named Simeon is there. He's an old man in his late 80s. God has told him at some point that he would not die until he saw and held the Messiah in his arms. His entire life was about recognizing and pointing to and saying, "Ah, this is Messiah." That's all his whole life was about this. And when that moment came, he was like, "I could die." So he's there in the temple. Joseph and Mary bring Joseph in. They're walking along, and here comes this crazy guy. I mean, come on. Everybody must have thought he was nuts. And I would have thought he was nuts. Been waiting for the Messiah for thousands of years. He hasn't come yet. It's not going to be here in our lifetime, Simeon, if it happens at all. And who are you to say, "I'm going to see him, and I'm not going to die until he does"? God didn't tell you that. You're just nuts. He's there hanging out in the temple like he always did, hoping the Messiah would come that day. Comes looking for the Messiah once again like he always did. And he sees Jesus, the baby Jesus, in Mary's arms. And I don't know how he knew, but he knew. The Spirit revealed it to him. Out of all the other babies he had seen come through there and be dedicated to the Lord day in and day out, this baby he knew was the Messiah. And he runs up and he says, "It's him." And look what he says. He takes Jesus up into his old arms, feeble, probably shaking, like, ah, okay, old man, please don't drop. The Messiah, right? Look what he says. You can find this in Luke chapter 2. It says, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people Israel. Can you imagine? He had fulfilled his purpose right there. People still probably thought he was crazy. Because nobody believed Jesus was the Messiah. That's why they killed him. Because he claimed that and they didn't believe he was. So they killed him. It was blasphemy. And then moments later, the old widow prophetess Anna, I love her too, who practically lived in the temple, comes over and starts telling everyone that this is the Messiah that they've been waiting for. God again picks the most unlikely, unreputable, discredited people on the planet to recognize and proclaim the coming of the Messiah. The one everybody's been waiting for. Then Jesus begins his public ministry by getting confirmed by the craziest prophet Israel had ever seen in the wilderness, where only the crazy, flaky, weirdo people were, John the Baptist, out there in camel hair eating locusts. I mean, who eats bugs? This is not exactly lend credibility to your ministry. I mean, if I start eating giant crickets because God told me to, y'all are going somewhere else. I mean, you love me, but there's a line. There is a limit to your love for me. If I start eating crickets and wearing strange fur, you're not going to stay. And these people, so who's going to be attracted to the guy eating crickets out in the wilderness? Weird people. And this is where Jesus goes to start his ministry, his big announcement. I am the Messiah. He goes to the weirdos, the cricket eaters. And even as an adult, when Jesus opened his public ministry after John the Baptist and he goes gathering, I'm going to choose the best of the best, the cream of the crop, the creme de la creme, right? My leadership team, these are guys, this is going to be the seed that begins worldwide revolution. The gospel will spread through these men. I must choose wisely. Look for good character, humility, maybe some education so they can learn all this teaching I have to give them in such a short time. I got some really complicated stuff, heady stuff. Got to be smart. Maybe a couple of working class guys, but really we need to focus on the upper class guys because that's where they need to be culture makers. You know, I mean, culture trickles down. So if we start in the big places where culture is made, where all the money is, then we change things faster. It makes sense, right? So let's go for those guys. No. It goes for a bunch of working. It goes for sheep herder type people. He couldn't find sheep herders, so he got fishermen. Uneducated. Full of themselves. Crazy, stubborn fishermen. Who knew nothing that the world will look at and say, you're going nowhere. Not only that, but he didn't go to the synagogue or the temple or the public square to announce his coming. His big announcement, his big show-off, his first miracle was making wine for drunk people at a rowdy wedding party because his mother was embarrassed that there wasn't enough wine. All right, Mom. Son, get out there and make wine! We've run out, there's not enough! They're still here. Make some wine. All right. That's his big miracle. That's his big opener. Making wine at a party. Jesus spent his entire ministry running from the crowds and intentionally doing things to thin out the crowd because it had gotten too big. He was constantly trying to get away from the big crowd that was gathering around him because of his awesome miracles. Seeking out obscurity. Saying crazy things like, eat my flesh and drink my blood. Are you insane? That's not going to draw people. You can't build a ministry on stuff like that. Don't say that, Jesus. I don't even know what you mean and I don't like you. I'm with you all the time. You say things like that and I just wonder, like, what's going on? Well, here's Jesus again. People just walking away. If only they knew what he was really like. At least Jesus, at least give them an opportunity to get to know you. So why did he do it this way? Just read Luke chapter 5. We're going to close with this. Luke 5, verse 27. After this, he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth. Remember what tax collectors were? I explained it a minute ago. These were not just hated because they were greedy. They were traitors. They were fueling the oppression. They were allowing. They were the financial resource for the guys who were coming to their house to rape your wives and daughters. Hated and legitimately hated. We wouldn't have liked them either, okay? He went and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." Really? You're going to get that guy? You're going to have that guy follow you? And leaving everything, he rose and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his house. And there was a large company of tax collectors and others reclining at table with him. So not only did he bring Levi, but Levi brought his friends. And they're all tax collectors. And the Pharisees and their scribes grumbled at his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." So I think you could say, if anything qualifies you for God's grace, it is that you were not qualified. So if you're claiming to be qualified in any way, if you're claiming that your righteousness or your goodness qualifies you for the Christmas story, it lets you in, you are exactly the one he did not come for. He came for the sick, he came for the broken, he came for the weak, and he began that way from day one. From the very first moment of his birth, it was not about the rich, it was not about the great, it was not about the mighty, it was not about the powerful, it was not about the religious, it was not even about the people who are sort of okay, it was about the broken, forgotten people of the world. At no point did he go to the rich. The only time he ever went to the kings and the rulers was when they were going to kill him. He went to them for crucifixion. But he came to us to rescue us, and to save us and make us whole and to heal us. You were not forgotten. You're remembered by him. I like to think that he would have at least considered me to be one of his disciples because I am qualified enough because I'm so unqualified. I hope if I was in his day, he would have passed me by and said, "Huh, he's just messed up enough to be on my team." I mean, remember in high school when you picked teams, you had gym class, that horrible moment, at least for me, if you're unathletic, and you're standing there in line, a big line, and the coach picks the two coolest people in class. I don't know why didn't he pick the, just missed. If I was a gym coach, I would just do things differently. But he calls two guys out. "All right, we're going to pick teams." And they start picking. What are they? And then there's like that, those two or three people left over. They're both like, "Do I want the short, fat guy or the tall, skinny guy who can't even walk straight? I don't know. What are we going to do here?" And you're looking at each other and you're trying to decide, well, maybe he can just stand there and hold his hands up. And that'll work, you know. We're the ones that weren't picked for the team. Jesus came for them. And he came for us because of that. He came in weakness because he came for the weak. He came for the sick, the lost, and the hurting. And this is why we worship him. This is what Christmas is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be about who has the biggest toys. It's not supposed to be about the glitz and the glitter. And it's not even a celebration of our prosperity. It's a celebration of Jesus coming to the broken and stepping out of heaven where he was the center of everything and stepping into absolute total obscurity. Why don't we stand up and pray together? Lord, I pray as we enter into worship right now that you would just put us in awe, not just that you came, but how you came and who you came to. God, that we would just, Lord, that our jaws would drop and you would make this all fresh and real and new to us. That you really did come for people like us. And everything that we do to try to look better than we are, to improve our appearances, does absolutely nothing to impress you. You are nothing to look at. If we had passed you in a crowd, we probably wouldn't have even noticed you there. So Lord, I just pray that you would infuse us with your holy humility and meekness, that we would be in awe of you this morning as we sing. God, that these Christmas songs would be real, they would be about something real. It wouldn't just be a tradition, something that we do because it makes us feel good, but it would be singing about the reality of the incarnation of God himself into human flesh. God who crossed the line into our natural broken world to reshape it, that we really are becoming what we already are in you. God, I pray that as we stand here at Christmas, that we'd be able to look forward also to Good Friday. That this baby that took on flesh for a reason. He took on flesh so that his flesh could be pierced. So that his flesh could be broken and torn from his body. That he took on flesh and blood so that his blood could be poured out. God, we're so grateful. And if God, if we're not grateful, if we're not really genuinely grateful this morning, would you, by your Spirit, make us grateful? Do a miracle in our hearts this morning. Lord, I pray Wednesday morning when Christmas Day comes, the day that we've set as the day we're going to remember your coming, Lord, I pray that your presence would be there with us. God, whether we're with a happy family or with an unhappy family or a broken family, whether Christmas has good memories for us or bad ones, whether we're lonely on Christmas or not, whether we have lots of money or no money at all. Lord, I pray that you would be with us, Jesus, by your Spirit. You'll be present. And that we would worship you over Christmas. In the name of Jesus, amen.